Well, I think we can get started. Excuse me. Good morning. My name is Peter Merholtz. I'm president at Adaptive Path, and I am moderating this panel on the future of the book. With me today, to my right, is Brewster Kahle from the Internet Archive. To his right, Terry Duquet from Cheskin, the design strategy company. And then to her right, Eileen Gittins from Blurb.com. We're going to do a pretty straightforward panel style. I'm going to introduce the topic. They're going to each kind of have a position statement, probably about 5 minutes, maybe 10, and then we'll have a discussion. And excuse me, of course, we're out late last night, and our voices aren't necessarily what they normally are. So if you want to be part of the discussion, in which we encourage, please stand up to the microphone to ask your questions. That way both everyone can hear it, and I think these are being recorded for podcasts and stuff like that. So that will be very helpful. So the future of the book is a topic that can go in many directions. And based on the people in this room, I'm sure we'll see some interesting kind of threads emerge. I got interested in the future of the book in the late 90s. I've been doing interaction design for, 15 years now. And I actually worked at the Voyager Company, which was one of the first e-book publishers. They used to publish books on floppy disks designed to be read on the old Apple PowerBooks. And they called these expanded books. Enhanced books, one of those two. And so I've been thinking about kind of the future of the book for a while. And in the 90s, you're not going to be able to read this, and that's okay, but in the late 90s, I started to explore the idea of what makes a book a book. What is it about books that's interesting? Why do people fetishize books the way that they do? Having done so much work in electronic books, for me, a lot of the book is, the book is the ideas that are contained within it. But I found in talking to people that for many people, the book is that physical artifact that they can hold, that they can scribble on. Perhaps most importantly, that they can smell. I can't tell you how many people would tell me how important it is to crack open a book and smell the paper and smell the binding. And like those visceral experiences are very important for many people. And so when we're thinking about the future of the book, you know, it gets caught up in these types of issues of simply a vessel for the text, and should books all be, you know, electronic and searchable and hypertextual and in one giant database, or is it about the experience of the artifact and the object and the ability to give it to others and to have it in your library and have it on your bookshelf? And what does this suggest for the future in terms of where we're going with digital technologies? And the directions we can take with these, right? You know, 15 years ago, you probably could have made a plausible case for the eradication of the book, and it's all going to be supplanted by little, you know, PDA-like devices. But obviously, that's not coming to pass, and probably won't. And why not? And what can we do with our technologies in order to encourage the kinds of book experiences that we want to have? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I'm now going to turn it over to Brewster from the Internet Archive, who's going to share what some of the work they've been doing with books. And maybe he'll talk a little bit about what you're seeing, this bright green thing in front of us is the $100 laptop as part of the One Laptop Per Child project. And he can talk a little bit about what they're doing with that. So, Brewster.
Thank you. I love any talk that starts with fetishize. So the digital future of the book, the future of the book, it's digital, right? That's the big change that's coming along, and the question is sort of what works and what doesn't in this world. I work at a nonprofit library called the Internet Archive. We digitize large amounts of film, large amounts of music, books. We have lots of old web pages on the Wayback Machine. Anyway, we're an enormous collection of materials that are basically in the commons. We basically are a home for the commons. We're free hosting for those that want to make things available online. So that's what it is that the Internet Archive does. And as part of this, we've been digitizing library books and working with publishers and putting books online and trying to figure out how do you do this in a way that continues to have an industry as opposed to having a single corporation run something. And I helped put newspapers online in the early 90s, and I'd say that was a success. In that right now, newspapers, you can go in to see full text of thousands of different newspapers online in such a way that they control the distribution of their work. Right? They may not be doing all that well, right? But they're trying, and they control their own. They're not all going through one iTunes. So I'd say iTunes would be the other side of the equation of sort of the complete centralization. That was sort of the AOL approach of sort of everything through one. And we're seeing kind of a couple different industries go online in these different areas. I'm a big fan of the distributed approach because the thing that I think that makes a book, yes, there's the physical form of it, but it's that there are great things in them. And why are there great things in books? Why have great things been written in books? I'd say it's because it's a single author or maybe a single illustrator working together to create a deep idea that takes hours to go through and understand. That's the essence of why a book, if you find a right book and hand it to somebody, it'll make them cry. There's something powerful about what it is books have been able to do, and it's because it doesn't go through large-scale committees of corporations and blah, 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 blah. I mean, you don't find that with television programs. You don't find that with a lot of other things, or music, actually, in the last 20 years. I'd say it's really coming from the heart, and it's a mechanism of distributing ideas in a very powerful way. This digital transition, I'd say, is going to really help the superstars, and it's going to help the long tail. And I'm really worried about the future of the book in between. The professional author that doesn't fly around on jets is actually what I think may be hurt. But let me go over some of the economics that we've seen change with this digital world to sort of at least ground it. We've been digitizing books. Large number of books. We've digitized about 100,000 to 150,000 books. They're available on archive.org for free downloading. And it's about 10 cents a page to do a first-class scan of a book. And actually, I've got some print-on-demand versions of these. I don't have one for everybody, but if you sort of distribute them, you guys get to end up with books. So it's about $10 a page. So about $30 a book to go and image a book such that it can be reproduced beautifully. So facsimile editions that don't look like faxes. So, beautiful stuff. 10 cents a page. That's cheap. That means you can go through whole shelves, whole rooms full of this stuff for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it is going on. Another is the print-on-demand area. We're going to hear about beautiful print-on-demand in a moment. But if you take black and white print-on-demand, sort of the sort of thing that you're seeing, the big change that happened is going from oil-based inks to toner-based inks. So oil takes a lot of setup, right? That's how newspapers are produced and large volume editions. Toner is how your Xerox machine works, your laser printer works. And we've now gotten it so that toner-based is cheap as long as you're not doing color. So if you're doing black and white, you can print at about 1 cent a page. So a 300-page book is about $3 to go and produce, including the cover, the binding, the whole shebang. $3 a book. That's really cheap compared to the $15 or $25 that we buy books for in stores. So that means that if you have things camera ready, it costs about $3 to go and put out. There are some interesting technologies for this that are coming about. One is we made a bookmobile. There's the size of a small van with a satellite dish on the top. And we pull out a table, printer, binder, cutter. Kids help make their own books. They can make the books that you're seeing being passed around. So in the size of a soccer mom mobile, basically a family van, you can have 1 million books delivered anywhere. And we even did this in rural Uganda. And it's up and running now in Egypt and India. So you can actually get books that last mile, a long, long way, cheaply and easily. There's now a new device called On-Demand Books. It's the Espresso Book Machine. And it's about the size of this table. And it has basically a printer, binder, cutter, and a little conveyor belt for going and moving the book along. And it's a kiosk machine. And we're bridging all of our 150,000 books, and we're scanning now 12,000 books a month, onto that machine such that you can just hit the button and for a penny a page, it goes thump, and you get a good-looking black and white color cover, perfect bound paperback book. So that's so we're starting to get inputting. It's going along fine. Getting things out is going along fine. One other thing that I'd like to show, which is kind of fun, is the $100 laptop. This, I have to say, I have to be a little careful with it. This is...
Get your cameras out.
this is there are 600 made in the first batch of $100 laptops. 300 of them were used for drop testing. So there are 300 left, and this is one of them. And so they, we're very privileged to have one of these. It's do people know what the $100 laptop? Okay, not very many. Okay, it's a nonprofit to go and make laptops for every child in the world. And the idea is to make something that's appropriate to be read underneath trees in Nigeria, and they're doing it. And this is one of the early ones. And the reason why we have one is we're a library for it. All of our books will be available to those that are using the $100 laptop because it has wireless ears and the like. Mm-hmm. So it's a full little laptop with a camera, a microphone, and you know, and the like. But it's also can be folded around into a little tablet. And so we made a little demo application of actually the same book that we passed around printed. And you have to... In this early, remember, it's completely early, right? This is the first beta of these things. You have to sort of stick your finger kind of in it, and it goes up and down for next and previous. And I'll just pass this thing around. If it stops working or something like that, pass it back up, and I'll reboot it.
Yeah, so please be careful with it.
But that is $100. And I just learned by going to a university that often textbooks cost more than $100 now. This is nuts. It's really nuts. So the idea of going and having a $100 laptop that could be 100 books or 1,000 books or 1,000,000 books could make sense. Some of the cool things about this little laptop, yes, it only costs $100. That's cool. Another is its 200 dot per inch screen. A 200 dot per inch screen makes a huge difference. So you can actually have things look pretty nice. Oh, try flipping the pages. Anyway,
hit the little, there's a little button there.
There's a little button. It's a little hard to do. Another is that it's sunlight readable. They did the technology right so you could read it in the sunlight. You can turn it into black and white mode and turn off the backlight and read it. Another is the battery life lasts 12 hours, not 2. So anyway, this thing is pretty neat. And we may see things that have enough volume to crack through because the little e-ink things, while beautiful, I'm not sure they're ever going to get the volume needed to do something. And we'll be sort of staring at our computer laptops trying to make them into e-books, which generally just doesn't work terribly well. So, point about this. Scanning is cheap. Printing is cheap. There's going to be some new technologies for getting things out there. So the digital revolution all looks very rosy. I think actually I'm more pessimistic about what's going on. I'm worried about the business industry that's going on. Since World War II, the book publishing industry has really taken a big fall, I would say. The book publishing industry worked for a couple hundred years after they figured out the royalty system and before anybody got centralized control on distribution. And it happened just after World War II, as best I can tell, with Ingram. And when they had centralized distribution controlled by such a few players, they can go and cause all sorts of disturbances in the market. For instance, the death of the small bookstores. And I would say it's a direct outgrowth of somebody controlling distribution. So we had Barnes & Noble and those sorts of things really sort of reaming out towards the user of what it is you can get access to. And back upstream, it started getting worse as the consolidation of the book publishing industry got basically put into just a few major publishers. Now we see another possibility of either further constriction, and it's these big search engines, most notably Google. And they're interested in having single point of control of how you find and disseminate information. And you say, oh, but Google's great, great, and they're good guys, it's terrific. But by having single corporations have that much power in the distribution, it really can ream out the system in terms of how you get information out there. The long tail, I think, is going to be doing just fine through little, you know, distributed approaches. The superstars find their way. It's the radical new ideas, the things that aren't politically very kosher. It's the oddball things that would never get anointed by the business development person of a major corporation that I think is going to suffer a great deal if we allow for further consolidation in the hands of fewer and fewer companies to control distribution. Winning side, I'd say, is newspapers in terms of control, distributed control of distribution. Negative side would be iTunes. I hope that we see more of a newspapers than an iTunes in the book world. Thank you.
Thank you, Brewster. And testify. Now, Terry Duquet from Cheskin. Yes, you do have to follow that.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Well, I'm going to be more optimistic. In fact, I'm really excited because I'm here to talk about the user experience. And I'm kind of like the Ralph Nader, just a little bit shorter and a little less political. But my background is that I've been the user experience lead for Netscape, Apple, AOL, and my job for the last 20 years has been to represent the user in technology, always reporting to the VP of engineering. But my job is to represent the user, and what I think is happening is we're asking the wrong question. Instead of, it is a book alive or dead, it's really what are the new user experiences that are proliferating and growing and coming out of these new technologies. So basically, the question I want to say, you know, the user is the center of the world here. And a lot of the talk I've heard outside of this, you know, conference is, you know, it's about marketing, it's about technology. I'm hearing very little about the user experience, and that's what I want to talk to you about and also share with you. So the first one that item I want to talk about is the user experience. The second item I want to talk about is the Y generation. And like former generations, every generation has new experiences, creates new things. So I think we have to take that into account about where we're going in the future, not just today. So you've heard a little bit about what I've done. And based on the user, you have to think about taking the content, but how is that content being formed and designed by the user in new context? If you think about other technologies, how technologies like TiVo or the iPod have changed the user experience. Same content, you know, TV programming, but used in a different manner, a new paradigm. So that's a question you really had to be asking yourself is what's happening with this new distribution and creation and marketing of the book. I work at Cheskin, which is in San Francisco, and what we do, we design strategies for emerging markets, whether that be China, India, or new technologies. And we always start with the user. We analyze the user and field with ethnographic work. We synthesize it, seeing patterns in how people behave. And then we create stories, and that's what I do. I create stories with user data, because the last thing you want with data is hundreds of papers, pages sitting at a shelf collecting dust. What I do, I create stories out of that data. And why? Because stories are compelling. You think of Joseph Campbell and the myths. Stories are so innate. It's about passion. That's another thing I don't hear a lot, passion. You got to love. I heard you say crying and joy. You know, that's the essence that you cannot dismiss at all. No matter how it comes, it's there. And that's the connection. And that's the added value. When you think about it in business terms, that's the added value that you want to bring. What is that passion? Those feelings, whether they be haptic or just, that's me. I remember that. So if I didn't make my point clear, it's about the user, okay? And we're all different. And I think Eileen's product about blurb.com, which you'll talk about, is brilliant. And because Eileen, we've only met a half hour ago. No, it's brilliant because Eileen is letting the user define what their experience is, the power. That's pretty incredible. So thank you. The second part I want to talk about is, based on Eileen, is the experience that you have allowed. You think about the experience of the traditional book, which is that you buy it. Okay, you might buy it in a small store. You go in, you know the vendor. It smells a certain way. But then you have the experience of a large vendor like a Barnes & Noble. You have the stimulus of hundreds and thousands of stimuli, both experiences, but very unique in their own way, and you have choice. What you have allowed then to expand on the experiences of the user, which is creating the book experience. Mm-hmm. That's pretty powerful and pretty new. And additional, now you've actually allowed the experience of publishing and distributing, another new. So when you ask about, is the book dead? No, I say it's alive, you know? Yeah. So, this is what happens when I get passionate. You've taken something that's only had two, you know, and I'm being very selective here, two experiences, and you've expanded it. And that's what technologies can do, okay, based on the user. So the other part is about the Y generation, and like every generation, new experiences come, you know, exponentially they're growing, like Moore's Law. But let's talk about, you know, right now, for example, in 2004 in the U.S., hours of TV viewing was 13 hours per week, and 5% of hours viewing on the Internet. So that was a total of 18 hours a week in the U.S. that people were watching content, whether on the monitor of their Internet screen or the TV. In 2006, TV viewing hours was up to 13 hours a week, and with 11 hours of viewing on the Internet. So that's a total of 24 hours. That's 6 extra hours of watching content. And we're just talking about, you know, really pretty mainstay distribution channels here, TV and the Internet. 6 extra hours. So again, I would say maybe here we have to question, what is the book? What is a book? Is it a linear story? Is it defined by its platform? But it's about content. Let's go back to the source. It's about content and storytelling. So when you think about what's happening to the available content that's growing, whether people are willing to pay for it directly or indirectly, you have to think about that it's on the increase. You know, the tail is going up. And so let me give you an example of what this means and what I do, too, about this user experience. We went out, and there was a teenager who she's an avid reader. You know, she reads a couple of books a week. Her bedroom is lined with books. But then she pulls out her iPod, and she's, you know, listening to audiobooks, and you ask, well, why do you have both? Why not one or the other? She says, well, you know, when I'm at school or traveling, I have 20 books on my iPod with me. I can't carry 20 physical books in my backpack. So what has happened is that her option, her allowance to read more and to do more has increased. So again, is the book dead or alive? No, it's growing. So basically, it's not about is the book dead or alive, it's about expanding the user experience. And it's your job as a publisher, as a writer, to understand the experience of what you're creating, designing it. And oftentimes it's already designed with your user. If you just go and look, observe, watch, and it's the little things. It's not the rocket science. It's the little things, like we mentioned in traditional, the touching and the smelling. Well, now if I'm reading a book, like my iPod, for example, I cannot tag. The tagging on that is really bad. You know, it's really bad. And again, going back to the Ralph Naderness of me, it's the little things. It's really the real little things. So all you got to do is oodle those up, those all those little things, and you've got it. So there you go. And that's only one cup of coffee. So thank you.
Thank you, Terry. And now Eileen Gittins from blurb.com.
Great. Thanks, Peter. So I am one of those people who smells books. So a couple things. First of all, for those of you who may not know Blurb, a little front end piece to my comments today. So we have free software. It works on a Mac or PC. You download it at blurb.com. And it is book design and layout software. And what's been fascinating to me over the last few days, we've been exhibiting here. We're in the trade show area. So if you want to come see us, we're there and have hundreds of books to look at. What's been fascinating is we came to this conference for the first time this year, and I thought, gosh, you know, these people are filmmakers and musicians, and they work in other mediums. They're creative professionals, but they work in other mediums. What is their interest going to be in a book? And what I found was that as people came over to our booth and talked to us, they would pick up the books, and then they just, like, wouldn't put them down. You know, they're doing this, and they're opening the pages, and they're going, wow, you know, and then they're asking, how much does this cost? And it's like, wow, you can make this. By the way, you can make this for $29.95. You can make this one for $12.95. And you can make this huge one for $50. I mean, these are in units of one. And so what we found is that there is something to the beauty here. it's not just about the content and it's not just about the information. So I'm going to lean very heavily on the beauty side of the equation and the amazingly tactile nature of books. I think that as we become more virtual in our business lives and even in our personal lives, we value things like this in a different way. They become even more valuable. So I want to share with you one book here that's very interesting, which is kind of a hybrid thing. So this is a musician. In fact, he's here in the audience today. And he built this book. It's his song lyrics. But what's really cool is in the back of the book, he has his CD. And what's awesomely cool about that is this just became his new jewel case. Okay, for those of you who are musicians in the audience where most of your work is now downloaded and your listeners, your fans, don't get to have that visual connection with you anymore. They don't get to read about you. Don't get to read the lyrics. This is a new way to think about how you might make that richer experience available to your customers. So very interesting. By the way, at blurb.com, when you make a book, you not only get the tools to actually make the book, because we're democratizing the tool side of the equation, but we're also democratizing the printing and bindery side of the equation, right? Because that's been, as Brewster said, that historically has been really hard to do, especially in four color, really expensive, not accessible, really hard to do. So when you make a book at Blurb, you get them back in 7 to 10 business days. By the way, you can order just one. We'd like it if you'd order hundreds or thousands, but you can order just one. And the other piece of it is you can also make the book available in our bookstore. So there are three things that we're trying to democratize: tools for creation, the printing and the bindery, and then the third thing is the distribution. And unlike more traditional publishing models, where the challenge has honestly been the tyranny of retail distribution, has been mentioned by the panel already, in the Blurb world, you can keep 100%. Okay, so we make money on the printing side. So when you put a book up for sale in the Blurb bookstore, you can set your own price for it. Say this book costs you $20 and you want to sell it for $30, you know, woo-hoo, we'll send you $10 for every book that gets sold in the Blurb bookstore. So our whole thing here is how can we enable people to make more books, tell their friends about the books they're making, and have a richer experience for everyone. I think in the old world, I'm sorry for people who are in traditional publishing, but in the traditional publishing world, the motivations for making a book have historically been commercial. In fact, I think of publishers as almost like VC for authors. You know, they're like, how big is your audience? How efficiently can you reach them? How fine a marketer are you? Can you build a big market? And then if the answer to those things is yes, then they give you funding, which was known as an advance, right? And then hopefully you earn that back over time. Now, in the long tail world, where we can digitally store a book file for, you know, a marginal cost of almost nothing forever, all of a sudden, those economics change dramatically, right? So you can make a book, have it in the bookstore, and over a period of time, if you sell 100 copies, 200 copies, or 300 copies, and you make enough money to buy a new lens for your camera, that is awesomely great, right? We think that's a fantastic business model. So we're definitely in the long tail business, and we're definitely in the enablement business. Couple of other comments I want to make, and that is, I actually think the big idea here, the really big idea, is that there is an audience for every single book that will ever be created. The problem has been historically people have not had the access to create all those books, and they certainly haven't had the means to distribute them. But now that you have both the access and the means to create economically and distribute, imagine all the books that can be created. I'll share with you, I made a book at Christmas time for my family. I raided my dad's slide drawer. You know, I took a pillowcase full of slides to a scanning service in San Francisco, and they gave me a CD back. And I dragged and dropped them into a book, and I scanned some letters from my mother and photographed some artifacts and put it in this book, which ended up being about 250 pages. And it took me a weekend to do, but I have bonus points that I can cash in for the next 3 years with my family. And not only that, there's probably an audience of 5 people around the world who care about that book. But you know what? They really, really care about that book. And my father has Alzheimer's. And he really cares about that book because they're photographs he took and he can remember 30 years ago in a way that he can't remember 30 minutes ago. And so the final point I want to leave with you is making books can be a very, not only a tactile thing, but a very emotional thing. And this is the big learning at Blurb, the number of people who, for whom this hits a real emotional chord, whether they're a consumer just making a family book to give as a gift or share or for fundraising purposes, or whether they're a marketer who are trying to promote their business. This is a really interesting book right here. This is actually a laundry service in New York City, and they are marketing their book with different covers. Sorry, it's called, this is actually a laundry book, Permission to Get Dirty. They've now printed 500 copies. They've printed 100 copies each of 5 different covers, and they are target marketing them to different audiences. This other woman here, this is her new brochure. She has all of her contact information in the back of this, and it's her little sampler portfolio book. It costs $12.95. So you can see the ways in which books now can be shaped to promote your business and promote your work, as well as for gift giving and obviously also for commercial gain. I think those are my comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, I see someone who is raring to get up to the microphone, and please do. I think before we get started on that, I've kind of noticed a couple of themes or threads, and I'd love to, we could either follow those, or if there's things that we haven't touched on that are crucial, please let us know. One was this idea that there's, excuse me, these new technologies essentially are allowing new opportunities in terms of what we mean by books and how big books have to be and how big an audience for a book has to be. And we can, thanks to these new technologies, kind of satisfy any number of new experiences. That was kind of the point that Terry was making. Folks saw the recent issue of Wired magazine about snack culture and how we're getting kind of more bite-sized, perhaps, in our approach to media. But there was an article in that called Snacklash by Stephen Johnson, and his point was it's not just that we're getting bite-sized. The forms of what we're developing are just kind of exploding. So there's a lot more small stuff, but there's a lot more big and long stuff, too. And the technologies are providing these opportunities for this variety. So that was one thread. The other, which Brewster brought up, I'm thinking about it as kind of the future of the archives of the book, right? What Brewster's trying to do with the Internet Archive, open access to all books, he kind of threw it down to Google Books, what he's concerned is a single corporation locking access or controlling access to this knowledge. And I know that the product manager for Google Books is in the audience, so if you would like to speak on Google's thoughts on this, Adam, I encourage you to get to the microphone and share with the rest of the group. Adam's the gentleman in the glasses and beard. He just raised his hand. So, it's important. I mean, this is an important discussion to be having, and I think we have an interesting opportunity to have it here. So, if you would like to stand up to the mic, please let us know who you are, and please share your thoughts.
Hi, my name is Karen Krebs. In 1982, I published a best-selling trade paperback through traditional means. I now wish to self-publish a collection of magazine articles that I've written in Austin for the past 5 years, and am trying to decide, do I go with Blurb, Lulu, Lightning Source? How do I decide which of these options? And now my advisors are saying, you don't want to just publish a book. There's the question of how do you get bookstore distribution, or do you just do print on demand? You need the guy who mails them out for you, that kind of thing. People are telling me now that I need a blog and a podcast and to build, you know, the topic of the book is intimacies, love, sex, romance. So they're telling me build a community. And it just keeps going wider and wider. And I'm wondering, how do I get a book? You know, how do I
get a book out there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And how do I make money from it? That's the important thing.
Well, yeah, people have to pay rent.
Shall I take it?
Please, Eileen.
Sure. So there are about 20 questions in there.
Yeah. But shall I stay here?
No. Yes, please stand there. So one thing you said at the very end strikes me, which is, and I've heard this from musicians as well, they no longer make money on their music. You know, they make money on their merchandise and concerts and other ancillary things. They make some money in the music. Mm-hmm. I think the same is happening to authors at some level, too. So your comment about building the community and your site and your blog, yeah, you know, I think that's all the marketing stuff that you need to do to build an audience.
Does the money come from that, though, by giving people subscriptions to private parts of my blog, or does it come from the merchandise of the book?
Well, I think it can come from both, but in your case, I suspect you're building an audience of people who then are so captivated by your musings on your blog that they're going to want to actually purchase a copy of your book, which brings me to the second point. And I think companies like Blurb and Lulu, who are here in the audience as well, and a few others of us, I think we do a very good job of, when you have an audience, the economics of making your book available at, for instance, blurb.com, where you retain 100%, well, that's pretty damn good. I mean, now you can't get much better than keeping 100%,
but
right?
But can I get it in bookstores if I go with Blurb?
Sure, sure. And what you can do is you can get an ISBN number yourself. You put it on the back of your book, right? You drop it in, and then you can go get your book into book distribution. You can do that yourself over time. Blurb will probably help you do that. You can also get your book into Amazon through their own store. But as you know, those kinds of distribution mechanisms are really good for building an audience of people that you don't know. They're good for reaching people you don't know because you give up a lot, right? It's not uncommon for you to give up 40% of your of the retail price of the book. But they are very helpful for getting a wider market base. For the audience that you know or that you can drive, I think it's not a zero-sum game anymore is what I'm trying to say. You can make your books available in multiple locations, and for audiences you know, you may want to drive them to a location where you, the author, frankly, can retain a lot more of the proceeds than in classic retail distribution. So I think the answer is, unfortunately, yes, and yes. You should do all of those things.
Right. But it can be daunting, so you're going to have to figure out what you're interested in doing. I know Brewster wanted to comment.
I think you're going to have a really hard time. So, I'll be the downer here. Let's take your case in 1982. You got a book out, classic distribution. You can make some money on it. That was, a small-scale author, right? Not a Stephen King, not a self-published, family album. It's that middle zone that's really going to be increasingly difficult to really keep a vibrant, and it's where the ideas come from. The idea of paying for lenses for your new camera, I can see, or sort of loss leaders for your speaking tour, I can see, but it's this industry in that middle zone is actually going to be more and more difficult to play into, and you'll need to play all sorts of different cards, and it's challenging. I think the technology is actually not helping you. Sorry.
Sorry to hear that.
Splash of cold water. Yes.
Other people will make money, just not you.
If you could just let us know your name and your affiliation. Yes, you're at the mic now.
Okay. John Slayton from the University of Texas here in Austin. And the question I have for all of you and for, is it Adam back there, the Google Books? As you can probably tell by my companion down on the floor, he likes to read and he needs audio access. He needs text, and he needs the tools to be accessible as well. I'm thinking about Blurb, and I love the idea of being able to go and download software that I can use to craft a book and get it printed and so on, but those tools need to be accessible to me so that I don't have to use a mouse to access them, and my screen reader can tell me where I am on the screen, so I'm clicking the right buttons and filling in the right things in the right fields and so on. And similarly, for the wonderful projects of scanning the existing print library of the world, and Brewster, I heard a talk you did at the Library of Congress a few years ago about getting the whole world into digital form, and I like that idea a lot. And I like the idea of the Google Books project, and my university is actually participating in that, and I think it's terrific. But I want to make sure that those aren't just images of pages, because if it's just an image of a page, I'm dead. I'm a scholar. I like reading not just the most recent stuff, but all that old stuff. And my productivity as a researcher, my ability to serve my students as a teacher often depends on my ability to get hold of the older materials and read them and think about them and mark them up and make notes. And projects like yours, Brewster, and Google Books hold out just amazing promise for providing people with disabilities access to things we couldn't even have dreamed of 25 years ago. But it doesn't just happen.
Right.
Somebody actually has to think about it.
Right.
And so that's my pitch, and then I'll turn it into a question and ask, are you thinking about it? And if so, what and how can we help you?
So we'll start with Brewster and then Eileen talking about kind of how they're approaching issues of accessibility.
So let's take your sort of, you know, using these books that are going online for new and different populations, whether it's the visually impaired or people that want translations in other countries or put it on different types of devices, right? That's the opportunity. First, it starts with, are you allowed to do that? And then, are you encouraged to do that? I'm working in a project that both allows and encourages this. So it's open in the classic sense of open. And we make available the optical character recognition files. So basically the words that are on the pages in computer-readable form, such that readers now are taking the open content books and taking, you can look at images of pages or you can download the optical character recognition. It can read it to you in a mechanical voice. But even better, people are now building on these to go and do, for the books they care about, nicely read editions. LibriVox is taking our books and has now done hundreds of books in that sort of communal Wikipedia-like sense to go and build audiobooks and then putting those back up on the Internet Archive and linking those.
I didn't
know
they were using your stuff. That's good.
Yeah, so, and cool. Project Gutenberg is taking our scans because not only are they permitted to, they're encouraged to take open books and make them available in all sorts of different ways. So, yes, there are at least there's projects like that. I'm unaware of Google's allowing the OCR files to be used in different ways, but maybe that will happen at some point.
Great, thanks.
So I'll give just a brief...
You have to... I'm sorry, Adam, if you want to respond, please do so at the microphone. Thank you.
So currently one of our partners, Michigan, is giving away the OCR text. Google is not currently providing the OCR text from our site currently. If you actually go to the Michigan site, one of the reasons I feel like we're not doing that is that, frankly, we could improve the OCR a lot before we actually start doing things around accessibility. So there's some contractual issues in terms of providing OCR for the works that we make available through publisher contracts. But for the public domain, we do provide the images today, and people are free to OCR them and do with it as they wish.
May sure. I just ask that? Let me ask that again. There are public domain books that are available that are PDFs.
Yes.
Can those be downloaded?
Those can be downloaded
redistributed,
today.
Redistributed, put anywhere on the net, do anything you want with them?
Yes, and Project Gutenberg actually, they have a separate group that takes a PDF and they can pick up the images and they can use
our
problem,
but there's a...
Hi, who are you?
I'm sorry. That's an issue I know about.
Okay.
Robert Nagel from
Telluride.org was talking. It's going to be hard to follow this, I can see. Let's go back to Adam.
Sit down somewhere.
let's go back to Adam, if you want to kind of, Adam, if you could respond to Brewster. And then I would like to hear Eileen's take on this as someone enabling creation and publishing and what Blurb is doing.
Sure. So at the front of every PDF that we distribute, there's a netiquette request. And that request basically says, please be responsible with this. You know, don't give it to every other competing search engine. Don't do a couple other things that we think, you know, may make it hard for us to spend the investment to scan millions and millions of books. But that's not a legally binding request. It's not an end-user license agreement. It's not a terms of service. It's very much a request from a company that's investing a large amount of money in this and is hoping that people will use these things in a way that encourages us to continue to do that work. So the question is, are we legally preventing anybody from redistributing these things? Absolutely not.
But what if we're to go and download these, OCR mm-hmm. them, make them available on the net and for different audiences? Would you like that?
So we would not like you to scrape the entire Google Book Search project and provide it in other places currently. We think that that would not be good for Google, which is a public corporation. We do think that it'd be great if somebody downloaded 500 of these and put them on a site and, you know, annotated them and used OCR text and did interesting things with them. So I think that, I mean, we're trying to find the right balance here. We're in new territory here. You know, we're spending a huge amount of money in this and we're investing in it, and we're trying to do it in a way that allows us to continue to do that. And if we see things where we feel like people are abusing this and making it hard for us to sort of provide open access to these, we're trying to provide open access to people, not for competing corporations. And so that's an important distinction for us at Google because we are a public corporation.
Cool. I see a lot of people in line, but I do want to let
you,
I do want to let Eileen kind of respond on the creator side of this, how you manage and provide for accessibility.
Well, I can be brief because we're a very young company, and I'm glad you're here today because you remind me that we should pay attention to these things. I can tell you the only thing so far that we've done here is we have an agreement with NPR where we are. Enabling authors, blurb authors, to actually tell the story behind their book in a podcast, right? And I think phase two of that, you could imagine them telling, actually reading their book as an audio file. Today, we're not focused on that, honestly, but again, I'm glad you're here. You remind me of that.
Thank you. Again, name, affiliation, and then your comment or question.
All right. My name is Jamie Stevens. I'm with the Center for Study in Oral Traditions at the University of Missouri. And one of the things that we're looking at is the user experience of new media in cultures that don't have their primary literacy of the people are not a textual literacy. They're more of an oral literacy. And so some of these, for lack of a better word, oral literacy. And so chances are with these $100 laptops that a lot of people in these cultures are going to get a laptop and an internet connection before they're going to get a library of books or access to physical books. And they're actually going to, their interaction with media and being able to navigate is going to be really navigating through these digital mediums. And so my question is, how do you see the user interface and the user experience of reading and of consuming that media differing, instead of just taking the pages, using the same metaphor of the page in the book and keeping with that as we digitize all these books? That's a metaphor that they haven't, that some people in these cultures have not had before. So is this the best way to represent this content that we're digitizing and putting in these cultures?
Wow. Thoughts?
I'll add one thought. If you have a chance, you should stop by up at the trade show. There are some crazy-ass books that have been made using blur. Sure, can I say that?
Crazy-ass books. Yes.
So there are some.
This is South by Southwest. You can even swear.
Oh, good. There are some really quite remarkable books that are not at all linear or page-driven that have been made, particularly by visual artists. So I'm not sure that our expectation for what goes on a page or what a page is needs to be the same in the future. So I'll just put that out there.
Let me just touch on that. First of all, you don't know because, again, I just returned from the Philippines where we're doing, we're doing a lot of work now in emerging markets, Philippines being one. And you really have to think about the socioeconomic issues, which a lot of us in the Western world do not think of. Think again about what we have. And just in the Philippines, you'll know that, you know, there's still a family tradition. You know, a lot of the, in a marriage, the one spouse will go off for 6 months on a cruise ship, sending money back. And so, the communities, the structure of the communities is different because of new economics. And so to answer your question is that it's changing. And you cannot take anything for granted in those emerging markets because of the flattening of the world. I think, again, I'm going to be positive. I think there's probably more of a need for communication, and it will take more in different forms. And actually, I think we in the Western world will be learning from these emerging markets, and that's the positive side of it.
Yeah.
So have fun. It's great.
Yeah.
I think again, the emotional, the oralness, the emotion, which again, being in Silicon Valley now for all these years, I still don't know why engineers can't get emotion. You know, all I want is, and when I was doing user interface, all I want to see is people smile, you know? That's all.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Name and affiliation?
My name is Brandon Bonick, and my affiliation is designcrack.com.
Excellent.
But that's what I'm, what I wanted to ask is not related to my website. My wife is the marketing director for City Lights Books in San Francisco, and arguably it's the, you know, it was the first paperback bookstore in San Francisco, thus democratizing the book in a way back when it opened. And we had a debate recently, my wife and I, about putting the books online. I had kind of suggested that she may consider putting all the new authors' books online for free, and it wouldn't affect their sales, potentially, from some other lectures I'd heard. How do I, first of all, is that a good idea? And second of all, how would I argue that case?
Wow. I know of some perhaps more name authors, folks like Cory Doctorow of Boing Boing has had a lot of success doing that, essentially giving away the book in digital form, and that has seemingly only driven sales in his print form. But you know, he's kind of rare, and I don't know if there's been much done in terms of the cannibalization of sales. I don't know if Brewster, you're...
Well, let's take City Lights in particular. City Lights is an astonishing store. If anybody's in San Francisco, go to City Lights. It's got its real founding, and I think it's still marginally a poetry. It sells a lot of poetry, which is very difficult to sell.
Actually, pretty much all the books are sort of left wing.
Now, yeah, it's becoming
Noam Chomsky,
more of a lefty political.
They only publish typically one poetry book a year.
Just staying last night with a couple of Iranian poets, and we were talking about how do you promote poetry. And there's print is one realm, and it really works very well in small editions, right? Because poetry doesn't tend to sell very large scale. And Noam Chomsky's different. But if we just take the poetry case, one thing that could help a lot is actually poetry readings. So you can experience somebody passionate, maybe the poet, maybe somebody else, reading the poetry and doing that in video form and putting that on the net. Mm-hmm. And then, the net might be used for something different than sort of a page-turning experience or distributing the poetry in that
kind of
way.
Some type of podcast might be pretty
handy.
That might
work really well, especially in the poetry area or even in the sort of the lecture-oriented left-wing The people like Noam Chomsky is great in lecture, and it's a lot easier to relate to him in lecture, I find, than in some of his writings.
I mean, I can't see how it could hurt. Again, you're giving the user more points of contact and building that. You're a conduit between that content and the user, so the more the better.
So outside of, like, maybe I should ask, you know, her to look at Cory Doctorow and see his success.
Well, I would also, I mean, speaking as a designer, this is something you can prototype and experiment, right? You don't have to commit an entire catalog to this, but try it with a couple books and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Find a couple authors who are interested in engaging in new ways and see if it works for them. I mean, you're standing right next to a gentleman, Michael Nolan, who works for New Writers, Peach Pit Publishing. They're a computer publisher that's having to try all kinds of crazy new stuff because things are changing, as we've been talking about. And, you know, whether it's making them downloadable as PDFs, whether it's making them available as podcasts, whether, you know, you got to experiment. So I wouldn't say that City Lights needs to release everything in free audio or PDF version, but there's no harm in trying,
yeah.
Particularly because right now there's a lot of harm in doing the same, trying to do the same things, right? So that's what I would suggest.
Can
okay,
I add one more thing?
Thank you.
I think you're, again, asking the question. It's, you know, it's really about asking the right question, mm-hmm. to get to the problem. The solution is that nowadays you cannot anticipate. If you anticipate, you're not going to be innovative.
Okay.
So you've got to get out there, and you've got to really watch what's happening, and then take that information you're getting from that and doing something in reaction to it, and carving and designing your own experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at A to B anymore. It's A to multiple points.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your question. We have probably time for maybe two more, definitely one more. So,
hi, I'm Jeremy. I come from the craven, crass, grasping side of corporate publishing. I work for Penguin Books in the UK. And I wanted to ask the panel about e-books and about, you mentioned that they hadn't really taken off yet. What do you think are the things holding e-books back? Is it the user experience? Is it the price of the content, the price of devices? And do e-books have a future?
Well, the price is always determined by the experience, right? That's a brand, added value. If you, I'm willing to pay X amount for a Porsche because it excites me, you know? A Chevy doesn't. So, yeah, it's economics of behavior.
I think there are a couple of applications that, I think earlier somebody mentioned the $100 textbook, and how that's just all wrong. I can imagine that's a fantastic application for the ebook. It's like, it's about the content. It has a relatively short shelf life in your life. You want it accessible in short chunks. I think that there are some really home run applications for ebooks, and I think as an industry or as a genre, finding a few of those home run apps will really enable it to take off. I don't think it's a replacement, by the way, for physical books for all the reasons we've talked about, but I also don't think it's an either-or equation. I think it's yes, and it's just a gestation thing. I think it is an experience design thing. Until it feels more comfy and more friendly, it'll be held back somewhat, but I think it's more the application of the content.
There's a bunch spent in the late 90s on the e-books. There's a lot of excitement around it, and there was actually a fair amount of investment in put into, usually was, I thought of it as sort of publisher on down, approach towards getting e-books out there. And large part, it seems to have been deemed a failure economically, user experience-wise, sort of every which way. And I would suggest that we kind of got it backwards. There are a couple mechanisms that we've seen new technologies get deployed successfully in such a way that there's a large industry at the end of it. And it's by starting with the public domain, starting stuff with you can play with and see if you can build a market to get critical mass of users. I was involved in getting what became the World Wide Web going. And that started with whatever the content we happen to have. And we kind of cobbled it together into services. And by the time there were 1 million to 10 million people sort of on this internet in sort of 93, 94, on the World Wide Web, that was enough of a market for people to start taking it seriously to jump into. As opposed to the sort of top-down, we know what people want, let's lock it down with DRM, package it, and sell it approach, which I think we saw in the late 90s didn't work very well in e-books. So I'm quite hopeful about ebooks actually working this time around, but let's do our experiments in the open in ways that we can try to figure out what do people actually want before we do a lot of corporate investment in it. So there's a lot of playing around. Take some titles, play around in some of the new things, try taking the DRM off. Does that matter? Do some things to just get some experience on it. I think that the devices aren't really all that good yet. It's working quite well for reference works, but it's not working terribly well for long-form novels and the like. So I'm hopeful that the ebook is going to do actually quite well, but I think we need to go through the playing around with the devices, playing around with the user experiences in the open before we can really set up shop and actually make a lot of money off of it.
Excellent.
Are you being more positive now?
He's being more positive. So one last question, and I'm going to ask the panelists to respond as if this were a lightning round so that we can let people go. Do we really have to just be done right now? Okay, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. It is a little after 11. They do need to let the next folks in here. Thank you. Feel free to talk to any of these folks.